The big question, and this changes for everyone, is why do you buy a wine? And do you know where that wine actually comes from?
As I like to say, there's life after Cabernet Sauvignon.
The most expensive wine in the world is a Bloody Merlot. Why can't we be in that group? We can be.
It is important to adapt your rootstock to the location where you are and what you want to grow.
There's a moment in a red wine fermentation where it gets really foamy, froths up in your face, and it smells amazing. I think that's my favorite part.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 307. This week we feature Brian Lesprince of Fenn Valley Vineyards in Fennville, Michigan. Our Michigan wine tour will be coming to an end with the next two podcasts, but let it be known, we will be back. This program features Brian Lesprince, Vice President, Operations and Winemaking at Fenn Valley Vineyards in Fennville, Michigan. As Brian put it, this is where a hobby gets out of control. We call that passion. We met with Brian at the tasting room on yet another snowy day in November. Variety, versatility, and warmth really describe this place. It may be off the beaten path, but isn't that where wine fans love to go? So again, continuing with the Michigan tour, I am here with Brian Lesprince, and we're here at Fenn Valley Vineyards, and we are in the town of...
Fennville, Michigan.
How you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for coming.
My pleasure. Thanks for making the time for us. Now, you know, we were chatting a moment ago. You know, we were chatting for a few minutes before we started recording, is that you're a bit out of the way versus some of the people we've talked to so far, but
sure.
A beautiful area near a nice lake. How did you end up here?
Well, we started in 1973. My father-in-law and his father actually set out to do this. They lived in the Chicago area and looked all over the Midwest, really, for farmland to grow wine grapes and eventually make wine. And originally, we kind of thought a lot of the industry would be up this way. There's some really nice land up here, really good soil, good topography. We're relatively close to Lake Michigan shore, so we get a lot of lake protection. And so all the variables came together on this particular farm. And it's been a great farm for us. But as the industry evolved, many of the other wineries decided to be a little closer to Chicago, which makes a lot of sense, right? It's a good 2 hours from Chicago here, and most of the other Southwest Michigan wineries are about half that far away. So we're kind of up here on our own a little bit, although there are more wineries coming into our region now than there were before, so it's kind of fun to have some neighbors finally. But our proximity has really helped us. We end up being a little closer to Grand Rapids, closer to Holland. Some of the lakeshore communities up here have really embraced us and really helped to keep us going over all these years.
I think this is the kind of place that people will want to search out, just or have wanted to search out. Obviously, you've been here for a while because it's just a pretty area. I mean, it's beautiful. It's fun going down the country roads trying to find a place.
And there's so much agriculture here that we really fit in, you know, whether it's tree fruits or blueberries and all kinds of stuff that's sort of sensitive to weather is all just nestled along the lake. And so it is fun. You know, the Chicago crowd comes up and really gets that immersive agricultural experience when they come out to the farm here.
Now, you said 1973.
Mm-hmm.
That I like how you react to that, because that's way before the Tasting of Paris, even for California. And that's, you guys were kind of ahead of the curve here.
Yeah, I that's a nice way of putting it. Crazy might be another way of putting
it. Yeah, at least that too.
Right.
That goes with the job.
Yeah. No, there was just a handful of winemakers. You know, Bernie Rank was, you'll probably hear his name when you get up to the Traverse City area. He was doing wine grapes up there. There was just a few. St. Julian was in business. They were pre-Prohibition. They actually came back after Prohibition.
Oh, wow.
But we, you know, we were one of the first to really get serious about it. And it was really just a hobby of my father-in-law and his dad that kind of got out of control, really out of control. So, but yeah, we had to travel all over and meet people to learn how to do it, because there certainly wasn't the resources that we have today as far as both formal education, but also just mentors and illustrations to follow.
When did you come into the business yourself?
We came in 2012. I was about 10 years in the software marketing world, which obviously prepares you well to be a winemaker.
Oh, yeah, perfect.
It prepared me well to be a wine drinker. And it was a job that gave me the opportunity to travel a lot. And so one of the things I'd always seek out was wine regions and wineries. And it was always a passion of mine. And when I met my wife, we enjoyed traveling to wine regions together and in Michigan and all over, really. And after a period of time, her father basically made the decision that if he was going to start kind of down that retirement glide slope, and he kind of approached us and said, you know, it's not, I don't want to put any pressure on you, because do what you want, but if you want to do this, now's the time, because I'm not going to be here forever, and I've spent a lot of years making a lot of mistakes, and I don't want anyone to make them twice. So we came on board, and I was really working more on the sales and marketing side, which would have been my background. And our winemaker, who had been here for almost about 15 years, decided to leave and start a smaller winery, which is something that we see a lot. We love that idea. We're a little bit on the bigger side for Michigan. And so I just kind of stepped into the job, and we talked about it for a little bit, and we said, you know, winemaking is going to be the core of what we do. It is who we are. And forever in my career here, it'll help to have sat in that chair. And so I took over making the wine a couple years into my tenure here, and then gave up the day-to-day operations a little under 2 years ago. I still oversee all the winemaking. I don't get to do the fun part as much as I used to. But it was nice to sit in that chair for a few years and really understand it at the core level. And it's been fun to watch kind of how we've evolved during that time period too.
Yeah, I looked down to see if your hands were purple, seeing how we're, you know, right at that time of year.
We are. I'm going to tell you what, we've still got a lot of reds to press out. It's been a good year. The tanks are full, and we're, there's many people downstairs with purple hands right now, I suspect.
So you're from this area originally, obviously, then, I'm assuming.
My wife is from this area. I actually grew up on the other coast of Michigan in Bay City, on Lake Huron, and then migrated to Lansing for school and then for work. And now I've worked my way as far west as I can and still be in the state of Michigan. So yeah. I'm back on the other coast, which feels a lot more like home. Growing up in around one of the Great Lakes is something that truly influences you. And so we love being over here.
All Great Lakes babies need to be near the lakes. It just works out that way.
Yeah, Lansing's wonderful, but it's pretty landlocked.
Yeah.
It's a different feel.
That's like mid-state, isn't it, right?
Yeah, right smack in the middle.
Yeah. It's just a very different feeling. And what a great area along Lake Michigan here, and as you come up this way, for growing grapes. This is one of those things where not a lot of people realize what great wine is being made up that way. That gives you a bit of a job, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a shorter season, obviously, than some other regions, but it is temperate. The lake does a great job of keeping us in a pretty nice growing zone. We get a little extra growing season from the lake. We get a little bit of a hold back in the spring, which helps us get through that really dicey part of the season in late April, early May for us, which is when we could start to see some green tissue out while it still be cold. So the lake is obviously the key, and we tell people that. We take people on tours all the time here. One of our things that makes us unique is we do tours out into the vineyard. We actually license the entire property as a tasting room so that we can go out into the vines themselves and actually conduct wine tasting. So in the fall, we'll take folks out when the fruit's getting ripe, and we'll, you know, pick a cluster of Chardonnay, have them try the fruit, and then have them try a Chardonnay. And it's really kind of a unique experience. And when we're out there, we're always talking to people about basically the factors that make this work. And the lake is obviously the big one, although there's others too. You know, the rolling hills and the sandy soils that we have here all really come together to make it possible. It's still extreme, though. I call it extreme farming.
Well, yeah, it's definitely a challenging area, but just going back to your idea of tasting in the vineyard, so mm-hmm. that has to be licensed for you to let people taste in the vineyard.
In the state of Michigan, any outdoor service has a special permit attached to it, and so, yeah, they don't just like you driving around in a hay wagon serving people wine.
Yeah, that could be bad. That's got disaster written all over it,
It kind of does, yeah. But people love it. I mean, it's one of the things we get consistently the highest marks for is our focus on education. Kind of like your mission, you know, we try to demystify the process. We try to make it wine approachable to folks. I try to teach them about wine labels on the tour and things that they can take away when they leave. Because, you know, once you leave, you know, winemaking and wine tasting is so unique. It's one of the only things you buy that you usually can try first, which is great. But if you're in the grocery store and you're, you know, running out of time and need that bottle as a gift or for dinner tonight, it's nice to know what a label, how a label works, right?
And they do frown on you tasting in the aisle of a grocery store.
Yeah, it turns out that doesn't work so hot.
Well, I mean, you know, when you come to a winery, the nice thing about it, you do get to try the product. You do try so many variations on the product. That's a real opportunity for people.
Yeah, we always encourage folks to try something on the menu that they don't think that they're going to like. Right. Or on tours, we pick the wines. So they're really kind of forced into it. And I always tell them, listen, you know, this is fun, so try it. You'd be surprised at what you might find that you like. And inevitably, almost every tour, someone comes up to me afterwards and says, hey, I didn't think I liked Chardonnay, but it turns out I've only had oaked ones, and your unoaked one really appealed to me. Or, you know, in our climate, we do have such fruit-centric wine that people who don't even necessarily always like a drier style will actually often like a drier wine from our climate, because that fruitiness comes through, and they can't believe it doesn't have any sugar. It's the fruit that they're tasting. And so it's a great thing, and it's a low risk, an opportunity to expand your horizon a little bit. And that's a ton of fun for me when I see people just blown away by a product that they never in a million years thought that they would like.
Yeah, sure. Do you run into a lot of conversions? Whites to red, reds to white?
Yeah, I mean, I think reds are seemingly gaining in steam. We're getting better at growing them here. If you look at our vineyards and look at the way we're farming now, we're doing a better job than ever before at getting things ripe. And so that the Bordeaux reds are the ones that are really benefiting from that, because they're pushing the envelope in terms of growing season. So I think it's two parts. I think the market for red wine in our region is growing, but I think we're also producing more and better red wine at the same time. So I'm seeing a drying out of the palate. We make 40 some odd products here, ranging from, you know, your really dry classics to, you know, sweeter style wines, fruit wines, and the whole gamut. And if you look at the sales of those products over the last, say, decade or so, it's a clear migration towards the semi-dry and drier styles of wine. I think some of it's demographic. I think the younger demographics are definitely trending a little bit drier. But even across all demographics, people, once they get into wine more, it seems like the palate just dries out naturally over time.
Well, I think you're to blame for a lot of that, because it's education. The more you teach people, the more they're going to say, hey, you know, I don't want to turn my back on that or lose that opportunity.
Yeah, and they love it, you know, especially when they can get a product that, you know, they didn't think they were going to like. You know, they pick up a Pinot Grigio or something, and prior to that, they've only now had this sweet fruit wine, and they try it, and it's kind of, I think, it opens their mind a lot, and then who knows where they go from there.
Yeah, exactly. The sky's the limit. Yeah. How many acres are you farming here?
We farm about 80 acres. We have a 240-acre vineyard. 90 is probably maximum of good grape land. I mean, it is, because it is such a challenging environment, we are ultra picky about where we put grapes. And of course, some of them are easier than others. We grow everything from some of the hardest to grow in Sauvignon Blanc and Gewurztraminer that we probably see maybe 50% of the seasons we get a good crop on because of cold damage, all the way to your hybrids like a Sauvignon Blanc or a Chamberson or something that are much more consistent. Our farm is about 50-50 in terms of your hybrids and your vinifera.
Since you've been working this for such a long time, have you had to do a lot of replanting at all?
Yeah, we have. You know, sometimes because we've just put the wrong thing in the wrong spot.
Yes.
You know, we were just meeting yesterday about that, and there's some areas of the farm we'd never planted before that we planted several years ago and that we think they're fantastic. We've got some Merlot and some Pinot Meunier up on this ridge that on paper looks fantastic, and so far they look good. But in our climate especially, we always say that first, you know, let's say 8 to 9 years is the honeymoon phase. Most of the vines seem pretty happy. It's that next 10 years that really tells us if that was a good spot or not. And so we've definitely done some replanting, both in terms of you know, marketplace changes and, you know, customer preferences. We've gotten our own confidence has gone up, so we're able to plant things that are harder to grow. Our risk tolerance has changed too, so we can plant things that maybe aren't going to produce as big of a crop every year.
I like the phrase risk tolerance, because that could be taken a couple of different ways. It's like, yes, it's our charging forward, and yes, we're complete idiots and we're going to try anything. So right. I all due respect, but yeah. There's a science to it, but still Mother Nature's going to tell you what you got to do, right?
Yeah, it's, I would say farming wine grapes in Michigan is one handy thing is you don't have to go to the casino to go gambling. You just do it at work every day. It's truly, you know, we look at the sites. That's why so many of the places we won't plant, because we'll look at how many years, on a 10-year average, how many years are we going to get an acceptable crop load? And if that number isn't in the sevens or above, we're just going to leave that for something else. And that helps a lot. You know, you see it in the farm, the areas where you've got really good slope and really good soil, and the plants just look happier and healthier there. And so as we look to evolve in the future, we'll continue to take advantage of those spots to put the hardest stuff to do. And it's fun to do the risky stuff, though, too. We're big enough that we can do that. I always tell people on tours, our farm is kind of like your investment portfolio for your retirement. You've got, depending on where you're at in your life cycle, your risk tolerance might change. We're in a pretty good spot right now. We can tolerate some risk. We've got enough, you know, kind of experience and enough built up that we can have some fun things to grow that kind of help keep us on the map, so to speak. Gives us a challenge, gives our winemaker a challenge, our farm manager a challenge. But then we want to have the blue chips, too. We want to have stuff that allows us to make wine every year, because, you know, an empty glass doesn't taste very good either.
No, a lot of air does not. Nobody knew good.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm a little curious about your situation in terms of labor around this part of the country. Well, first, though, are you doing a lot of mechanical harvesting at all? Or?
We do. We do a lot of mechanical harvesting. We do a lot of mechanical pruning, hedging. We've pretty into mechanization. I mean, we recognize that as probably a good long-term strategy, but it's still wine grapes. So there's plenty of hand labor that goes into it without question. We work with a lot of growers that have converted from juice grapes, because this was a big area for Welch's for years, and they've kind of scaled back a little bit in our region. And so a lot of the growers have been migrating over to wine grapes, and they'll come meet with us and discuss kind of our take on it and if there's anything we would like to see them plant. And there usually is something, depending on, you know, what they've got to offer. But we always start by telling them, now listen, it's going to be a whole different ball game. You're talking about a lot more labor, a lot more hand labor, a lot of very timely activities that need to happen around here. You're battling a climate that's really a challenge for a lot of these grapes. And they generally agree, and within like 2 years they come back and say, why didn't you warn us, this was so hard, you know? And we're going, we tried to tell you, but it's really a lot different than any other agricultural entity that you could probably grow around here.
Well, I've said this many times, and I don't mean it in any negative way, but you know, you have to be half crazy to become a winemaker.
Yeah.
You've got so many angles to the business, your retail, your wholesale, your manufacturer, your farmer, your everything. And my favorite phrase is, as an individual, you're living in the past, present, future simultaneously.
Yeah.
That's really hard to do.
Yeah, and experimenting's hard because you get one shot a year to make wine. So any time thing you're going to learn is a multiple-year project. So that's a blessing and a curse sometimes, I think. It also means the market isn't going to be as fickle as maybe some other consumable products, because you just aren't going to see changes rapidly. I always tell people, if you want to make more of a nice Merlot or something around here, that's fantastic. You know, come back in 5 years, I'll have it ready for you. You know, it just takes a long time to expand and to really change your portfolio. Which is great, but yeah, it does seem kind of crazy. And combining agriculture and retail, consumer retail, is a sort of an insane combination for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. About how many cases are you guys doing here?
We'll do about 60,000 cases a year here.
Pretty good size.
And then we also do a fair bit of hard cider, which was sort of a project that we kind of fell into that's turned out to be kind of a lot of fun. But wine is still our focus. That's our bread and butter. That's what we're here for.
Are you distributing any wine at all, or is it strictly local? Or?
Yep, we do statewide in Michigan distribution, and then we also have a distributor in the Chicagoland area. A lot of our clients come up from Chicago. That this is kind of the playground of Chicagoland up this way. So we do try to get the product down to them as well. We're also pretty strong on our website. That was my background, being in software marketing. When I came here, we really spent a lot of time kind of revamping our online presence. And it's amazing how many customers buy wine off of our website on a daily basis. Most of them have been here. It's not like we're out there marketing necessarily to new customers, but they may have their, you know, annual pilgrimage to Fenn Valley. And what's nice is now they can experience us throughout the year if they want to.
I was kind of going the way of labor, and I didn't really finish. My particular thought was, do you have issues with labor here? You know, so many other wineries in different parts of the country are having active issues with labor. And I know even in California, they have moved in some ways to mechanical harvesting. But what about you here?
It's a little better here because we do have a more year-round labor need Grand Rapids is rather close to us, and there's a lot more work going on around here. But it's a challenge, and I don't see that challenge going away. So we are strategically aligning ourselves with more mechanized processes, investing in technology that will help to bring down some of the labor costs. We do have the ability to mechanically harvest a good chunk of our vineyards, although as a winemaker, you always want to hand pick everything. So if I can get away with it, I'd still like to go out there and pick it by hand. But when we get a year like this, we had kind of a challenging harvest in terms of weather. Having that machine out there really can save your bacon sometimes. But I think it's going to be a continual problem. There's no question about that. We need to just be prepared for that.
Well, another thing, too, about the wine business, and we've talked about this with many wineries, again, different parts of the country, is that it can be a dangerous business. Mm-hmm. Out west, you're dealing with snakes, critters. Here, you're dealing with mechanized machinery. Mm-hmm. And CO2 in mm-hmm. general. Mm-hmm. It's something you really have to be very diligent about mm-hmm. your employees and how everything gets done.
Yeah, I mean, especially in the cellar, well, farm's very dangerous, obviously, but in terms of the cellar, we really do like that we have a lot of experience down there. We have our cellar master has been over a decade with us, and with that experience does come in an innate sense of danger, basically, because you're up on catwalks over top of tanks full of carbon dioxide, pumping them over, or adding in a chilling plate or something. A lot of people who've never been down there don't realize that tank is nowhere you want to be during fermentation. Even the room can get a little thick from time to time when you come in the morning before you start opening things up, when you've got 12 or 13 open red fermenters going at one time. It's amazing, and you got to be real careful for sure.
In your case, you say you're not spending as much time down there as you used to. I'm sure certain things maybe catch you every now and then.
But not being down there as much is actually a big benefit to seeing things. Because when I go down there, I tend to see the forest now.
Yeah, sure.
And so it in both in two ways. One, in terms of safety, and second, in terms of efficiency. When I go down there, sometimes I see things, and it's not that there's a problem. It's just that my perspective has changed right now that I'm maybe walking through instead of hurrying up to hook up, 10 things at once.
Yeah, that's a very different situation. Well, that leads me to the next question, which is the most loaded one I have, and that is, what makes you crazy about the wine business?
It is true. You don't get in this for the money or anything. I mean, it's a lifestyle business for sure. I think what gets me going is just when you stand behind the tasting bar and you see the look on someone's face when they try something, especially in Michigan, because I'll be candid, we have a reputation for making sweet wines, for making a certain style of wine that we've been sort of clawing our way out of for decades. And we earned that reputation. I mean, especially pre-Prohibition, we made the wine that was on the bottom shelf in the big jug. And so what I view that as an opportunity, though, because when you bring people in that really came in with this perception of pretty much being disappointed, you can wow them a lot easier, right? They're already predisposed to think that they're not going to like it. So that constant seeing that is been, it keeps you going, yeah. And when you're sitting there on the, Saturday night on your sixth day of harvest, and you just there's one little activity that's you should do it this way because it's going to be better for the wine. It's that customer's face that keeps you going. You go, okay, we're just take that hour. Let's get this right. This is in 2 years when that wine's at the tasting bar, we're going to be real happy we didn't cut that corner. And so just delighting people and wowing them and surprising them is probably my favorite part. It's also, I don't know that anybody who makes wine doesn't appreciate the transformation process. When you stand out on the crush pad and you try a grape, and then you come back, and some of them you remember. I mean, it's like you remember the box, that last box of grapes from a lot of fruit, and you almost remember it. You've got your eye on it through the whole process, and when you see it come out the other side, there's an inherent sense of pride there. But it's also crazy, right? Because you really are introducing a lot of things that are way outside of your control that somehow you're going to be responsible for when all the dust settles.
That's true, but you also kind of make a really good point that wine is made in the vineyard. You have a personal relationship with those grapes. That might sound silly to some people, but not to you. You're a farmer first.
Yeah, we always say, and my father-in-law says this probably mostly seriously, that any idiot can make wine, and he'll put himself out there as case in point, and then I would follow in his footsteps and have certainly proven that as well. It's the farm that makes the wine good. You know, we just change it at best, you know, not screw it up is half of what we do, which doesn't sound glamorous, right? It's in some ways it's not, but when you have a really good year as a winemaker, it's such a dream. You get into some years, this year was one of them, where it's a little bit more work as a winemaker, but again, it's not due to the farm managers doing their job. It's just Mother Nature throws us a curveball here and there. But it's true, the good wine is made in the vineyard.
And that is the perpetual challenge of Mother Nature. Mother Nature's not going to be kind to you. It's going to do whatever it feels like. So whatever may happen is what you have to pick up with. Again, other than all the other stuff I mentioned before, you're a weatherman too.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got like 14 weather apps on my phone, as most farmers do, right? It's amazing. And everyone's got their favorite, you know, and favorite for this type of weather situation or that. You know, the lake throws the weather for a curveball all the time. You know, we're getting snow now where the rest of the state's not getting any because the lake's nice and warm. Sometimes you'll see systems come across the lake and then they hit the land and they're just gone. It's like they magically disappear when they hit the dryness of the lake shore. So I feel like our meteorologists really do actually earn their keep here. You know, I thought, well, if you're a meteorologist, go do it in San Diego. You just wake up every day and say it's 70 degrees and sunny out here. You've actually got to go do some real work. And, you know, we are seeing, and there's research to kind of support this, that we are, you know, it's warming, our area is warming, which is probably good for wine grape growing, but the problem that the challenge we're going to face is the erraticness of the weather.
So being a winemaker, and this is broad, what do you like to drink?
Oh, it's kind of like who's your favorite child, right? stylistically, though, I really like aromatic whites, your Sauvignon Blancs, dry Rieslings. I really like rosés. I like your Seigneur kind of Burgundian style rosés, where there's just a uniqueness to that. We do a Seigneur here because it's a technique that obviously a cold climate could benefit from. So I'm familiar with the process and like to find them when I go out shopping. I love my Bordeaux reds. Naturally, I think most winemakers probably do. We make a Meritage here that is probably the one bottle I take to the island. If, you know, stranded on an island, what's your one bottle? It'd probably be that one. But I like to experiment with different stuff too. We're doing some fun, interesting experiments right now. We're doing some pet nats where we're doing a finish in bottle where you actually, at like one brick, throw it in a champagne bottle and let it finish naturally. See how that goes. And it's fun to experiment with that kind of stuff too.
And we were talking before, you make Pinot Meunier, so you are making sparkling wines.
We do a lot of sparkling wine here, actually. I mean, it's not one of our big pushes, but it's been an increasing for us. We do Champagne Method right here on site.
We have all
the equipment to do disgorging right here. It's a great climate for that. I mean, bring in the stuff a little early, a little higher acid. The fruit flavors are great. So yeah, we do a classic Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and Pinot Meunier blend in a champagne method finish, and it's a fun product to make. A lot of work, but it's fun.
Oh yeah, definitely a lot of work. So we're here, obviously, at your tasting room, which is, again, in a wonderful setting here. Yeah. I am assuming people can just walk in. It's not a by-appointment facility.
We do both. So we do have walk-in 7 days a week, all but 4 days a year. But we also do take reservations, and more folks are doing that, which I think it's nice because then we can sort of prepare for them, especially in the slow season, because we might need to bring an extra person in if it's a group of, you know, several. But yeah, we've always felt like, especially in the middle of nowhere like this, when someone makes it all the way here, we better be ready to sell them something.
Middle of nowhere makes it that much more fun, as I said before, to find it. But on the web, if they want to learn a little bit about you, how would they do that?
So yeah, our website is fennvalley.com, just our name. There you can find information on all of our events, all of our tours. You can book tours online, which I'd encourage. You can buy wine online. Pretty much everything that you can do to learn about us, you can learn about there. Or if you wish to call us up, you can call us at 269-561-2396. You can also find us on all the typical social media, Twitter, Facebook, etc.
Brian, I appreciate it. We're obviously here in the tasting room today, and there's a crowd here, so people will hear that. This is a working winery like every other winery. It's all about keeping the business going, making a profit. Thank you for taking the time out of your day and hanging with us. I do appreciate it.
Thank you very much for visiting us.
Learn more by visiting fennvalley.com or check out michiganwinecollaborative.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Additional original music by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Photos by Jeanette Herniak and Catherine Shearer. Copyright 2019.